going deep. I feel like Kalo on the Miami Heat. The words I speak off this sheet are like a three-peat. I don't just hop on a track, I bring running cleats. I'm a player for real, more than an athlete. Let my mama tell it, could have ran for the Senate. Instead I penned it for Donovan Bennett. I'm cemented, this a deep dive. In your headphones or a long drive. Up close and personal, just like you courtside. There ain't no out of bounds here, no offsides. We going live in 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You are now tuned in to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
Thank you so much. Capital is the Going Deep podcast, and we are going to go deep and really put a bow on the NCAA tournament, men's and women's, because it was an outstanding tournament, a real fun watch on both sides of the bracket, but also was really good to see a couple Canadians show out in the Final Four. It was also amazing to see what dynastic programs look like, and I know UConn back-to-back and South Carolina, two championships in the last 3 years, but they're set up for continued success, so we might be seeing them back in the Final Four for years to come. Let's start with the ladies' side of the bracket, shall we? And why shouldn't we? They, in terms of the Final Four and Final, had more viewership than the men did. So if you are someone hating on women's sports and its viability, well, we just had another data point tell you that when you invest and when you market and promote, there is a massive audience for women's sports, specifically women's college basketball, and there's a massive audience for the South Carolina Gamecocks, even though some publications led with the story of Caitlin Clark, even though South Carolina went undefeated and won. The 10th undefeated champion, going 38-0, fifth program to win three titles. There's are in 2017, 2022. I actually think their 2023 team was their best team that lost to Caitlin Clark in the Final Four. And then obviously they won again in 2024. You get why Caitlin Clark is a massive story. She took over the tournament and ends, I would argue, having the best NCAA career, male or female, scoring record, single season 3-point record, most points in a single season in women's history, most career points in the NCAA tournament, most career 3-pointers in the NCAA tournament, and she left some eligibility on the table, y'all. How do you make sense of those types of numbers, both by an outstanding program and an outstanding player? Before we talk men's college basketball, which we will do after the break with Arash Madani, ladies first, ladies first, ladies first. We holler at Haley McGoldrick to talk to us about the women's tournament and the strong performances, both individual and team. So, Haley, there are so many takeaways, so many thoughts and thought starters I have, not just from the national championship game or the tournament at large, but women's basketball in general. But I don't want to be too prescriptive for you. The biggest takeaway when you think of 2024 women's NCAA basketball and the championship game that we just saw, your takeaway and the thing that's struck you the most is what?
That people want to watch women's sports. I think that's the biggest thing, because you're seeing these viewership numbers that are millions. 17 million people watched the Iowa-UConn Final Four at its peak. You're seeing millions of people. You saw that open practice for both Iowa and South Carolina sold out. That's thousands of tickets that sold out to watch that practice. I think that's the biggest thing. Even going into these games, you saw that the ticket prices for the national championship, the get-in-the-door price, was higher than the men's game. And so I think that's the biggest thing, is that if you build it, they will come, and people wanted to watch these games. And I think that's the biggest takeaway, is that it's incredible to see how many people were tuned in, locked in to this national championship and this tournament at large, watching women's basketball.
Yeah, say louder for the people in the back. obviously, I agree. I mean, so much so that you had me out here fighting on X or Twitter with Bobby Ryan, which I don't suggest anybody does. But yeah, I felt the type of way. But I really loved the growth. I am concerned, because you had a couple generational talents in this tournament, which piqued generational interest. If those numbers don't translate in the exact same way to the WNBA or the tournament next year, although still being high, I fear, like in any market, there are peaks, and that might take away from the thought that in general, the arrow is trending up. Do you have any concerns in terms of how high a bar this tournament has set?
Definitely. I can see what you're saying. Absolutely. Caitlin Clark, generational talent. People were tuning in to see her, especially being in the national championship. People wanted to see if she was going to get that storybook ending or not. And you're even seeing for the WNBA that the Las Vegas Aces, their game against the Indiana Fever, they've moved from their home arena of Michelob Arena to T-Mobile Arena in Vegas because it's a bigger capacity. But when you look at these things also, you see that the Las Vegas Aces moved that game and people are saying, well, because the Indiana Fever are likely to draft Caitlin Clark, that's why they're moving it. But they also moved their game against the Chicago Sky, which has nothing to do with Caitlin Clark and everything to do with the fact that the Aces are back-to-back WNBA champions. They have so many talented players like Asia Wilson, like Kelsey Plum, like Chelsea Gray on their squad. And when it comes to college as well, I think the biggest thing is, yes, people may have tuned in for Caitlin Clark, but you saw in that Final Four game, you saw Paige Beckers, and Paige Beckers is coming back for a fifth year. You saw what a player she is. She's somebody that people are going to want to come back and watch and see if UConn can get back to their national championship winning standard. You saw even in that national title game, a freshman like Tessa Johnson for South Carolina, people are going to want to come back and watch her because they saw her play in the national title game. Of course, are we going to see the numbers that Caitlin Clark drew every single year? Maybe not, probably not. She is a generational talent and people wanted to see what she was doing. But also, I feel like it's great that she brought 17 million eyes to the sport, because there's people who are going to stick around because they watched her play in the Final Four and saw Paige Beckers. They watched her in the national championship game and saw a player like Tessa Johnson. And so I'm not concerned that nobody's going to watch next year just because Caitlin Clark's not in it. But yeah, you're right. Of course, there was so much interest because of her, but there's definitely people who are going to stick around because of the fact that she brought eyes to the sport, people who maybe haven't watched college sports before, but now they're going to be a fan.
Okay, in no particular order, I'm just going to fire at you all the things throughout the tournament that I was curious about or was thinking about or felt the type of way about, because I want your perspective. One being, in the NIL transfer portal era, have we ever seen something like what we just saw from South Carolina? They essentially only lose to Iowa, evidently, is if they didn't lose to them in the Final Four, that have gone 2 years undefeated. But this is a different team. They flipped an entirely different starting lineup. They lost impact players, both Canadian and American, from the team a year ago. Put in perspective what Dawn Staley has done, becoming an undefeated national championship and winning her second title in 3 years, her third title since she got to SC.
I think the biggest thing is, Dawn, is you see it when you're watching her halftime interviews, her post-game interviews, even when she was being interviewed by Aaliyah Boston. She doesn't take credit for herself. Aaliyah Boston's asking her, what did you do at halftime to get your team into gear? And she just immediately goes, Aaliyah, I'm so proud of you. I'm so proud of what you're doing. She takes her post-game speech and she thanks Caitlin Clark for being the GOAT and for lifting women's college sports. I think it's just that not only is Dawn a player herself, you saw she was in the WNBA, she's won gold medals with USA Basketball, but she is a coach that people want to play for. She is like a mother figure for these players. And also she's incredibly good at her job. Like you said, her third national title since 2017. And she built this program from the ground up. When she was getting there, the 2015 Gamecocks, they made the Final Four, but they hadn't gotten there yet. And I think the biggest thing is that she had learned from Carolyn Peck. Carolyn Peck gave Dawn Staley a piece of her national title winning net. And she said, hold on to this until you win your own. And that Dawn's whole thing is that she constantly builds up players and she cares about them long after they've graduated or left South Carolina. And like you said, this was a team that lost, you know, their five starters last year, their freshies class. They lost Aaliyah Boston, like you said, Leticia Amy here, who's Canadian. They lost a lot of players, but she's just somebody that people want to play for. You look like a player like Tahina Pau Pau, who transferred to South Carolina, and she knew that if she transferred to this school, this is a school that you're likely going to win a title at just because of the standard that you play at South Carolina, but also the fact that Dawn Staley is just a coach you want to run through a wall for. And I think that's the biggest thing, is when you have that support and you know that obviously she's got generational players around her. You've got like Camila Cardoso, who transferred to the school as well, knowing that when you go to South Carolina, the standard is so high and you're likely to at least see the Final Four, if not the national championship. And that's why the standard is so high, because Dawn Staley is just such an incredible woman, both on and off the court.
Yeah, certainly beloved locally. I love the fact that she spent time one-on-one with every local outlet after games, giving them time, just understanding where her bread is buttered, if you will. But it felt no type of way about upsetting people on both sides of the aisle. Earlier in the tournament, she got criticized because she thanked God too much. At the end of the tournament, she got criticized for saying she doesn't have an issue with trans women competing in NCAA basketball. The question it being posed, her response, the Twitter X social media cycle that spawned afterwards, what did you make of that storyline as we got to the Final Four?
I think the biggest thing is that, number one, the outlet that asked it, OutKick, if you know their coverage is essentially trying to get those kinds of reactions out of people. It's certainly, that's the way that they're kind of clickbaity. That's their audience. They ask those questions to try and garner certain responses. So first and foremost, the person who's asking that, I saw a lot of people say it was annoying that that was asked, purely for the fact that it is so hard to get into those press conferences and ask genuine questions to somebody like Dawn Staley, let alone a question like that that's clearly just trying to garner outrage response, etc. But the way she handled that is so classy. And she even said in her response, "I know that this is going to stir up a storm. I don't care. Let it." That's why I love Dawn Staley so much. She's somebody who, she stands her ground and she sticks by it. And like you said too, she's a very religious person, constantly thinking, God, if that's the way that she runs her program and that's her religion and how she thanks God for helping her get in basketball, everybody is entitled to their own ways. And I think what makes Dawn so incredible is that she sticks to it. She would never let the media push her around. She's been in this game for a very long time, both as a player and as a coach, and she stands on business truly. And I think that's what makes Dawn so incredible, is that she took that question and she knew that it was trying to spark outrage, and she said, "I think women are women and they should be able to play women's sports," and that's that. And I think she handled it incredibly, and she knew that people on Twitter were going to come at her and she didn't care about it.
And the reporter who asked the question left the press conference immediately after asking it, so it was there to do one job and not necessarily to cover the sport holistically. The sport is getting more coverage, which is great. Unfortunately, the byproduct of that increased coverage is that when everyone has an opinion, they tell on themselves on how much they haven't been paying attention to women's sport for a long time. And so it's like that double-edged sword where we want to be mainstream, you want exposure, but is that going to come with the hot take arguments and the narratives that don't make any sense? How do you balance the fact that it's amazing, this conversation is leading the A block of shows and on the front pages newspapers, but like, I'm gonna have to listen to these tired ass people talk about this when they don't know what they're talking about. For someone who's so entrenched in it, how did that sit with you?
The thing is, I can definitely see both sides, because I am very anti-gatekeep. Everyone has to start somewhere. Not everybody grew up watching the sport, and that's okay. If this March Madness was your first March Madness, if this year is going to be your first year watching the WNBA, that is completely okay. But I think the biggest thing, like you said, is that people don't just ask questions, they just already have opinions. And I think I saw one, for example, that made me laugh, because they said, "Oh, the sport doesn't have, like, the WNBA doesn't have a villain yet. We need a villain in the WNBA." And people who actually watch the WNBA were like, number one, Diana Taurasi, even before all of this discourse about Diana Taurasi saying Caitlin Clark is going to have a rude awakening, even before that, like, people were saying, "Hello, Diana Taurasi." Even players like Marina Mabry, she's kind of got the villain to her. Sophie Cunningham, there's that picture of her and Kalia Copper when the Phoenix, Mercury, and the Chicago Sky met in the WNBA Finals, because Sophie Cunningham's got a villain arc to her. And it's just, the biggest thing is that I think people form their own opinions before asking questions, and it's okay to ask questions. I think that is the biggest thing, because like you said, it's incredible that people are tuning into women's basketball now, but you don't have to know everything. Even when I first started, I didn't know everything. I did research. I asked questions. It's okay to not be an expert on a sport you just started watching, but people watch a few games and then all of a sudden, like you said, have all these opinions and start saying them. And it's like, well, not that you have to watch the sport for 20 years to understand what's going on, but sometimes maybe just ask a question or maybe run it even by somebody who you know has been watching the sport a little longer before you go out on social media and say those things and then get clowned when people say, what do you mean there's no villain in the WNBA? Have you looked into the WNBA for 5 seconds?
Well, it's funny because at the same time, online, there's a huge conversation of WNBA players sharing their welcome to the WNBA moment. And I feel like, and it could just be the algorithming for me, but I feel like almost 50% of them were different players saying, oh yeah, Diantre Rossi did something wild or out of pocket to me. Like that was a common denominator that, you know, she could, you know, act like she's your friend only to do something that would be villain-esque on the court and feel no tape away about it. I love that you brought it there in terms of the term villain, because it's one that has been used quite liberally in discussing the tournament. The LSU team was described in an article as dirty debutantes, which if you Google it, like, is a term referenced in porn more so than sport. And this conversation really stemmed around Angel Reese. A year ago at this time, we had the conversation on how when Angel Reese did something on court, it was perceived entirely differently than when Caitlin Clark did the exact same thing 48 hours earlier. But Emmanuel Acho took it a bit further and mentioned the fact that Angel Reese should own being the villain, not cry post-game in a press conference, and had the disclaimer before he had that take that his take was with no view on race or gender, which is almost like saying, I don't see color. I'm not really sure how you can talk about a female athlete without talking about their gender or their race. Were you surprised at the level of reaction to what was a pretty vulnerable moment for Angel Reese?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is obviously people didn't forget about last year, which again was just two competitors in the heat of the moment having fun. You saw even after that Elite Eight game against Iowa and LSU that Caitlin Clark and Angel Reese were embracing. They have so much respect for each other. They're competitors, but people just don't let things go. And like you said too, the whole race thing of it and people saying those things about LSU, when would you say that about a team that is predominantly white in their starting lineup? Like, it's just disgusting to see, truly. But like you said too, we, I think, as in a society watching sports in general, I think men get it worse for sure. But when athletes show emotion for some reason, that really outrages people, as if they're not human before they are an athlete. Somebody who just played their last college game for a team that were the defending national champions, who wanted to go run their title back, are now out in the Elite Eight. That's definitely an emotional moment. I even think when I played high school basketball, I cried at my last game for high school basketball. Like, it's an emotional thing, especially for somebody who has had a great collegiate career, is now, of course, going to go to the WNBA, but that's a chapter of your life that is now closing. And for people to just turn it on, oh, you're upset because you lost. Well, it's more than just the loss. This is the last time playing with teammates who are like sisters to you. This is the last time suiting up for LSU, which has been such a important chapter in Angel Reese's life. And so for people to just turn that and say, oh, you're just upset because you lost. Like, she's a human at the end of the day. She's a young woman and she's allowed to show emotion. I think that's the biggest thing too. You even saw in the post-game presser after the Iowa-UConn game, Paige Beckers was upset. She's going back to UConn for a fifth year, but she was upset because that's her last game playing with her teammates, Aaliyah Edwards and Nika Mule and things like that. It's just an emotional time because this is a chapter of your life that's coming to a close. It has nothing to do with, oh, we lost to Iowa. Yeah, it sucks that they lost general. It doesn't matter who the opponent is, but people just have had this target on Angel Reese's back since the national championship last year. And no matter what the girl does, she's scrutinized for it.
Obviously, you know, as fans and viewers, we love high level competition, but we also love storylines. And I wonder how much of the interest of this tournament and the Final Four, and specifically the finals, is the culture wars aspect that spurned from the conversation around these teams. You have Iowa, which is Midwest team that's predominantly white with, you know, Nike jerseys repping the Big Ten. And you've got, you know, South Carolina, which is obviously South and repping the SEC, a team that's predominantly black with a black head coach, repping Under Armour jerseys. And it just felt like, you know, it was almost like a gang war that people wanted to watch via basketball. You know, the LSU game certainly, and then the South Carolina game after that. Do you think that aspect specifically, the United States of America, tapped into an appetite to people to be interested in this big game?
I think so, but I think it's a combination of certain storylines, not even just that's definitely a storyline that people were looking at. But you even look at the last three games Iowa played. Of course, their Elite Eight game was the storyline of Angel versus Caitlin again, national title game matchup. Then you look at UConn Iowa, which that's more of a lineup of, you know, UConn's team has a predominantly white starting lineup as well, but that's more Caitlin Clark versus Paige Beckers, because Paige Beckers was the number one recruit in the 2020 class, whereas Caitlin was number four. And then, of course, the national title game is, yes, those storylines, but also the fact that, like you said, Iowa defeated South Carolina in the Final Four. They ruined their undefeated season last year, and that was the freshies class with Lelia Boston, that Dawn Staley said after winning this year that they did it for the freshies because they couldn't get it done last year. And even the storyline of Raven Johnson, there was that clip last year of Raven Johnson and Caitlin Clark gave her about 20 feet and kind of waved her off and said, I'll let her shoot that three, whatever. So Raven Johnson said this was Raven's revenge tour because she was kind of the joke of the internet when Caitlin Clark didn't care to guard her. And then you look at Raven Johnson guarding her, kept her to 1 of 5 field goal shooting in the first half against Iowa in the national title game. And so as much as, yeah, it is a little bit of that, Iowa and South Carolina are two completely different teams who come from two completely different worlds. And like you said, there's definitely struggles that players on the South Carolina team have faced that I'm sure players on Iowa will never have to face in their life. But it is a little bit more than just kind of the surface level, what meets the eye. There's a lot of underlying storylines as well that went into this game, which made it so much more entertaining because there was a lot behind the scenes also from years past that went into it.
You mentioned UConn. I'm still not over it. Poor sip out for our girl, Leah Edwards. You saw it. You watched it. Give me your perspective on the call. Foul? No foul? Foul, but you don't make that call at that time. What did you think of the quote-unquote illegal screen heard around the world?
I agree with your third point. Foul, but you don't call it at that time. Up until then, they were playing physical basketball. They're not making the calls. They're just letting them go at it. And then 30 seconds left, a one-point game, and you're going to call an illegal screen like that? Like, it's just one of those things that, again, was it the right call to make? Technically. But when you've let things go on for so long in this game, obviously players are going to adjust to that. They're going to adjust the way that I know I can do this because it's not getting called in this game, or vice versa. I need to make sure that when I'm on defense, I am watching out for these things because they're not calling these illegal screens. So to call it with 30 seconds left in a one-point game, it's just something that you've already let them play nearly 40 minutes of physical basketball. Why is that the call you're making now? And I will say Paige Becker said it best post-game when she said, whether I agree with the call or not, you cannot make the outcome of a game a single call. If you're the better team, you're going to win that game no matter what the call is. And you even saw at the end there, Caitlin Clark makes that really high IQ play where she bounces the ball off Paige Becker's to waste clock time and get the ball back for Iowa, things like that. But if UConn wants to win that game, they have to be a little bit better. But it was a call that I believe shouldn't have been made due to the fact that they had allowed so much physical play throughout that game. But also I agree that if you're the better team, if you want to win that game, you cannot have the entire game hinge on a single call.
And Gino Auriemma post-game mentioned the fact that they were called for illegal screens. The opposition wasn't, so maybe they need to be better at not having illegal screens, kind of saying it tug-in-cheek, showcasing the fact that it was somewhat slanted without just using it as an excuse. The funny thing is, when I'm thinking about this tournament and was watching Gino post-game, I remember when he seemed to be a personality almost bigger than the sport. Certainly him and Pat Summitt in Tennessee. And now there are so many great coaches, so many interesting stories, so many players and programs that are interesting. And we are probably the only people who have talked about this tournament for 22 minutes and not mentioned Kim Mulkey. And for a while, it seemed like every story was about her, whether it was her getting ahead of a story, talking about the fact that it shouldn't be something that people gave any credence to the fact that the story came out from the Washington Post, which I'm interested to hear your take. I didn't really find it like that deep or interesting. I struggled to get through it. But if we're looking for, in some spaces, a anti-hero or a villain, Kim Mulkey's putting her hand up and saying, make me the target. What do you make of her brashness, both with her team and with the media, and the way that she's been covered?
I think the biggest thing is that a lot of people will look at Kim Mulkey and they will defend her a little bit because they'll say, okay, she won titles at Baylor. She won titles at LSU. If you want to win basketball games, you go play for Kim Mulkey. But I think at the end of the day, like I said prior, you're a human before you're an athlete. You should have a coach who respects you, who believes in you, not somebody you look at players who were openly gay and they said Kim Mulkey wanted nothing to do with that. She said, keep it out of my gym. I don't respect that. When everything with Brittany Griner happened, she didn't even acknowledge it because Brittany is an openly gay player. And a lot of players saying their treatment that they had at Baylor, even some LSU players. And it's just, at what point do you say, I don't care how great of a coach you are. I don't care how many basketball games you can win. I'm a human first and I deserve respect. And like you said too, I think the funniest thing about everything is that she was so defensive and then the Post article came out and it wasn't really new information. It was saying, yes, she doesn't really care for gay players or even some players of color felt like they were being treated differently than white players. But that's not new information. We've known that about Kim Mulkey. Even you think during the COVID bubble year and Kim Mulkey was saying, oh, we shouldn't be testing these kids anymore, whatever, just let them play basketball, when COVID was killing people around the world. You just know that she's not really a great person and also a great role model. That's the biggest thing. You want to go play for Dawn Staley because not only is she a fabulous coach, she is an incredible role model. That's somebody who you look up to if you want to have a career. Even if your career doesn't end up in the WNBA, you know that Dawn Staley is going to be an incredible role model for whatever you do in life because she's somebody who will completely support you, completely have your back, versus Kim Mulkey. Yeah, maybe if you go to LSU, you will win basketball games, but how are you going to be treated by her? And especially as a player, you're such a high-level athlete, a Division I athlete, you're spending a lot of time with that person. You're seeing her more than you're seeing your friends, your family. If she's not somebody who's treating you with respect, is that really somebody that you want to go play for?
No, would be my short answer. Definitely, players are going to want to continue to go play for the two coaches who were coaching in the final. And I thought the game was very entertaining, very fascinating from an X's and O standpoint, but somewhat binary. He had an outstanding player in Caitlin Clark who could score even over great defense and create opportunities for her teammates with her threat to score and passing ability. And you had a team with no player nearly as good, but much deeper and much bigger. And it was just kind of binary in terms of what teams will would bend to the others. We saw Iowa try to mix in some zone there to negate some of the athleticism of the SC off the bounce. But it just seemed like this is a game of possessions, and unless Caitlin can continue to score on almost all of them, like she did in the first quarter with 18 points, SC is just going to have more of them because they killed the glass on both sides. Is that too reductive? Is there more nuance in what played out in the final?
No, you're correct. Definitely number one, the rebounding was huge. A player like Camila Cardoso, and also, how do you stop a player like Camila Cardoso? She's a big player. She's physical. She can score. She's going to control the rebounds. Nobody on Iowa has that size that she has. So stopping her is number one. Even if you're playing a zone and you're going to double team her, then you're allowing players on the outside to shoot. So you're allowing Pow Pow, Johnson, both Tessa and Raven to score. You're allowing a player like Ashlyn Watkins to score. There's just, like you said, South Carolina had so much depth. And that was the biggest thing, was their bench points. Iowa's bench contributed 0 points, which their bench wasn't a deep rotation because three of their starters played 40 minutes. Kate Martin, Caitlin Clark and Gabby Marshall all played 40 minutes. So Iowa's rotation wasn't running that deep. So when you're expecting three players to contribute more than 6 points, you're not going to win a basketball game. Whereas South Carolina had players, they had multiple players who were all in double-digit scoring. Chloe Kitts was another player. She's a forward who had double-digit points. She's out there on the glass. And that was the biggest thing. Not only stopping Caitlin Clark, Raven Johnson was playing incredible defense on her in that first half. Like you said, after the first quarter, they definitely had to do something, change something up. When Raven Johnson was Caitlin Clark's primary defender, she kept her out, and that's why she only finished the game. I say only finished the game with 30 points. But when you have 18 first quarter points, having 12 through the other three quarters isn't a lot for somebody who we've seen drop, you know, close to 50 points in certain games. And then, like you said too, just the depth of South Carolina versus Iowa's, when you have none of your bench players contributing any points. And that's not a game of points. There's definitely players who maybe they only contributed 6 points, but you look at their defense. But due to the fact that they weren't able to stop Camila Cardoso, they weren't able to stop South Carolina shooting mid-range or from deep, that was the biggest difference. Because when it comes to Iowa, yes, there's players like Hannah Stolke who had an amazing game, players like Kate Martin. They have, it's not just Caitlin Clark, it is a team effort. Hannah Stolke had an amazing tournament for Iowa, but when you shut down Caitlin Clark, that does take away a lot of their offense. And then for a player like Camila Cardoso as well, when she has the advantage on the glass, that makes a difference as well.
Any players for Iowa outside of obviously Caitlin Clark would have been in Carolina's rotation? Are there Martin, Marshall, any?
I would say Kate Martin had an amazing tournament as well, as did Hannah Stolke, but just the way that South Carolina clicks their chemistry, I think that's the biggest thing, is that I don't know if they would get into their starting lineup just due to the fact that Dawn Staley has a certain formula. She knows her players. She knows that they're going to feed it to Cardoso. Well, if they can't feed it to Cardoso because she's being double teamed, okay, we're going to kick it out to Pau Pau. She's going to be able to shoot a three pointer. So I think that Iowa's starters were definitely talented and they deserved to be in that game. And it wasn't just Caitlin Clark dragging them to the finish line. But I think that South Carolina's starting five are five of the best players in the nation.
All right. I'm going to give you a real tough task. Try and say some superlatives about Caitlin Clark that have not already been said.
God, I think that's so hard because obviously people are going to say what an incredible shooter she is, what an incredible passer she is. I think that's the biggest thing, is that you see some of the dimes she's dropping and half the time they don't even result in baskets and you're like, come on, that's such a good pass. I think she's an incredible leader. You see the things she's doing off the court, the thousands of dollars she's raised for food banks in Iowa. God, I want to say, you know, selfless in the fact that she's very selfless off the court. Maybe sometimes she needs to be a bit more selfish on the court and take those shots. But then again, you've seen her in some games where if she's cold, she's cold. But when she's hot, she's red hot. Oh, God, I feel like everything's been said about her, and for a good reason. She is not only just an incredible basketball player, but Lisa Bluter has said time and time again, she's such an incredible person off the court as well. She is a leader. She's selfless. She's a game changer. She's generational. But those things have all been said.
Yeah, what really surprised me, given that her rise has been relatively meteoric. Like, we've known about Paige Beckers, to your point, for 4 years. Caitlin Clark's phenomenon is, like, just over a year. Like, it was kind of going into last year's tournament where she started to become a household name and not just a name that, you know, NCAA women's basketball hardcores was familiar with. The fact that she's dealt with all the attention so well and is so eloquent in talking about not just herself, but the state of the women's game, given that she still is relatively, really young, is really, really impressive. I'm excited to see some of the behind the scenes of what her life looks like, because Omaha Entertainment, Peyton Manning's company, is doing a quarterback-like series on, you know, women's college basketball, and naturally she's going to be a part of it. The last thing I want to get from you in terms of, you know, a dissection and an analysis of some household names at the college level is, this was really cool to see two Canadians at programs where the expectation is Final Four and/or championship, playing starring roles, who have grown, always been good, but grown you know, systematically over the years, it's almost like, you know, we watch these kids grow up before our eyes, and then we got to see them, you know, in high leverage moments in the biggest spots. You know, Aliyah Edwards, Zach Edey, both who have credited spending time on our national team with their development. Be interesting to see as they enter their respective drafts what their pro careers are like. But these are names that you've been thinking about for a long time. As we send them off to the real world, what's your perspective on the two bigs on the men's and women's side that made Canada proud?
I think the biggest thing is that not only that they're just going to go play in the WNBA and the NBA, and they're not just, like you said, in the Final Four and playing for teams that have historically been up there and making their impact, but I think it just really also shows the growth of Canadian basketball. Before, you really had to search high and low to find a Canadian on even the men's side as well. We have seen more on the men's side, the women's side especially, it's been so hard. You're seeing even last year, up before Letitia Amahira got drafted, there were three Canadians in the WNBA, and that's it. And so I think it's huge because it really shows the growth of Canadian basketball that, you know, we're not just sending players to D1 schools who play in the NIT. They don't even make the NCAA. They're playing at schools that aren't, you know, they're playing in Final Four schools. They're playing in national championship schools. We have talent here that is so great, and our development on our national teams has been so good that we are pumping out players. You're seeing their young players now, like, for example, like Toby Fournier, who is going to be the next kind of up-and-coming Canadian that people are going to watch. I'm sure she's going to be on WNBA watch list in 4 years, but I think it's just huge, like you said, that Canada basketball has done a really good job in developing these players, and you saw Canada qualify for Paris 2024. They obviously didn't get the result they wanted in Tokyo. They had a great FIBA World Cup. It's just huge that Canada basketball is on the map now, and we are developing incredible players who are going to go play professional basketball at the next level. Canada basketball is on the map. Of course, USA basketball is always going to be USA basketball, but Canada basketball does an incredible job of developing their players, and it's really cool to see Canadians winning national championships, being up there, going for titles, and this wasn't really something you saw 15 years ago. Canada basketball has really done an incredible job in just keeping developing talent, sending them to NCAA, and then sending them eventually to the pros.
No question. As excited as I am for the men this summer, and don't get me wrong, I'm pumped. I'm really excited for the women. I think Quiet has kept their being slept on quite a bit. And, you know, over the last 4 or 5 years, between injuries, between college commitments, we haven't really seen our best all together at the same time, given that some of our college best are now going to be pro players. And obviously the pro game is going to stop for the Paris Olympics. I think this might be the strongest women's team we've ever fielded. It's obviously self-evident that the men's team is going to be the strongest we fielded, but I think the same is going to be true for the women, which is going to make a really, really exciting run. Hopefully we see, like we did in the NCAA tournament, both the Canadian men and women giving the country lots to cheer for. We will be following your coverage up until then and checking back in with you for more analysis and perspective. Thanks so much, Haley.
Thank you so much for having me, Donovan.
Thank you so much to Haley, who's done a great job for us writing on basketball, soccer, football, F1. I'm sure she's going to be writing for us in the summer with the upcoming Olympics. Don't miss any of her writing. At Goldie on Sports is the handle on X. Thank you so much. Someone who actually covers all of those sports and more for us is Rash Madani. After the break, we talked to him about the men's bracket of the NCAA tournament and the outstanding player in that field, Zach Edey, the 7'4" Canadian.
My name is Lucille Bryan.
I'm Clifton Bryan.
My grandson has a show.
And I'm so happy that you are listening to Going Deep with Donovan Bennett.
I'm so glad that he had a show. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Grandma and Granddad. And as I mentioned before the break, we're going to talk to Rash Madani, a guy who finds himself in more airports and hotels and stadiums and arenas than anybody in the business. We catch him coming back from Phoenix, Arizona, after the men's NCAA Final Four. So before I tuck my kid into bed at night, we read a couple books. He's a big fan of Where's Waldo. But afterwards, when I'm on the socials, when I'm going through my guide and my Rogers Ignite box, my real question is, where's Madani? What big sporting event across the globe is he covering? And the most recent one was the NCAA Final Four, which for sports fans, I would put on the bucket list of events to go to. But this one was special given that one, a Canadian, was not only in the Final Four, made the final, but two, because Canadian basketball icon, I think it's fair to say, and Vince Carter, at the Final Four, entered the hall. Madani, thank you for fighting the jet lag that I'm sure has accumulated to talk to me. What was it like for you to, you know, on one end, cover one of the many kids that has come through this wave of talented basketball players, and you had a female in Aaliyah Edwards on the other end in the Final Four, that I think is part of the growth of Canadian basketball as well. And the flip side, cover one of the landmark figures in Vince Carter, go into the hall professing, you know, to you that he goes in as a Raptor.
Yeah, and I thought that it's a great question, Donovan, because without Vince Carter, is there a Zach Edey? You know, that to me is the real question. You know, because you think about Edey, he only took up organized basketball 7 years ago, and since has been able to put together the greatest college basketball career by a Canadian ever in the NCAA, regardless of gender, regardless of era. Because on the resume, no other Canadian has two National Player of the Year awards. No other Canadian has been to a Final Four, and no other Canadian has reached the national championship game, let alone score 37 and 10 in it. And you think to yourself, well, how does that happen? How has a Canadian reached those heights? And yes, Steve Nash made people realize south of the border there's something going on up there in Canada, but it felt like for generations we were a two-sport country. When it came to team sports, it was hockey in the winter and baseball in the summer. And then along came the Raptors, but along came this phenomenon named Vince Carter. And when I chatted with him, one of the things he said he's a lot better with it now than he was before. And he said, Tristan Thompson came up to him one day and said, hey, man, you're my Michael Jordan. He's like, what are you talking about? How could I be your Michael Jordan? You know, Tristan went to Vince Carter's basketball camp as a kid. And then Kelly Olynyk came up to Vince. And Corey Joseph came up to Vince. And when Andrew Wiggins, as the number one overall pick, made his NBA debut, he did it with the Timberwolves in Memphis when Vince was a member of the Grizzlies. So this rise of Canadian basketball is kind of, to me, twofold on the NBA side. It's about Carter and it's about Nash. Nash allowed for the American awareness, but Vince was the one that inspired the generation to actually do it. And that all kind of came to a head this past weekend in Arizona with the National Player of the Year, taking Purdue into the national championship, and then Vince, first ballot Hall of Famer after a 22-year career.
You know, the funny thing about Edey is even the fact that we are now so familiar with his game that we can see, you know, Big Ten basketball games on television, that we can see literally every game in the tournament start to finish on television in Canada, in a way you could say is due to the success and popularity of Vince Carter. That's not something that was as ubiquitous for Canadian basketball fans to be able to have that access, you know, a couple generations ago, certainly. Edey, though, I feel like is a real interesting one because of the story of how he became Zach Edey. When you look at the national teams in the junior level that it came up with, he played with players who were more highly recruited, who were five stars, who, if we were betting who was going to be a two-time National Player of the Year, we'd have picked a lot of guys on those junior national teams before we picked Zach Edey. Zach Edey was just really young and really big.
But at the same time, let me just stop you there. At the same time, Jamal was a one and done. Shea was a one and done.
Yes.
Wiggins the same. Like, the thing with Edie is, and he continues to improve. He continues to develop. He's old school. RJ, one and done. Edie spent all 4 years. So that's why the career, in part, that's why the career is what it's been. And that's why he kind of has that spot atop the college basketball mantle. But I digress.
No, it's a great point. But he's old school in the sense that, a lot of other players would have maybe left after last year, if not before, maybe transferred out early. He's old school in terms of this era in many different facets. Studying him, as you have and getting a chance to be around him and others in the program, what sticks out to you about his ascension specifically?
Well, I mean, a lot. One, that he entered college with very little recruiting interest. For instance, I mean, why? Well, he'd only played 3 years. He was a hockey player and a baseball pitcher before that. So he's tall and he's lanky and he's awkward and he's very raw. But, and I know this sounds hyperbolic and cliche, but it's true. That kid has turned into a 7'4", 300-plus-pound, icon in college basketball. One of the greatest players in college basketball history because he put in the work. And that's what, if you talk to Matt Painter, if you talk to people in the Purdue staff, if you talk to people on the national team staff, I saw it myself this summer in Asia when I was there with the national team at the World Cup. The last dude on the floor every day was Zach Edey. Edey made the point after Monday night, Donovan, that, he shouted out a couple of the Purdue assistant coaches saying, these dudes have wives and families and they're sitting with me until 6, 7, 8, 9 o'clock watching film, doing extra one-on-one work because they saw something in me and they believed in me. Edie had a village. There's no question. Edie has a lot of resources without a doubt, but he had to go do it and he's done it. And there's a want to there. You just think about, say, the start of last basketball season. The first year he won one of the first of two National Players of the Year. If you went back to, September, October 2022, and you asked somebody, where's Zach Edey going to end up after Purdue? They would have laughed at you. They would have said Europe somewhere, maybe. That's in the fall of 22. By the spring of 24, as we have this conversation today, it won't surprise me if he goes in the first round of the NBA draft in June. Like that's saying a lot. And that's because of the development, that's because of the work, that's because of the time that he's put in for somebody who was just a big man in the beginning. And look what he's done in the last 7 years to turn himself into a first round NBA worthy basketball player.
You mentioned the village that he has. Big part of that village is his mother. Now, I'm a sucker for parenting content, so when you posted a photo of her at the press conference and told that part of her story, I was all in it. But you mentioned some of the other players, whether it's Shea or Wiggins. Not to be a therapist, but I think you learn a lot about these guys when you learn about what aspects of their approach they get from their mom. What did you learn about their relationship that stuck out to you?
Well, the biggest thing that stuck out to me is that when Zach went to West Lafayette to go to Purdue, mom moved to Indiana too. And she was a support network for him, not in Toronto, but she was in the mix. Learned that Zach and his teammates go over to mom's for home-cooked meals. They play cards over there, a good escape from what they're doing. Learned that mom played basketball in high school. She was the tallest player on her team. Wonder where Zach got those genes from. So she understands kind of what it's like to be an athlete. And for her, she's just like, she's like, I understand how, you know, there's gratitude there that she's able to be there, able to show up. She's a retired engineer. She's been able to be there for the entire ride. So Zach said, you know, it keeps me grounded having mom around. It's great knowing that she's there at every game of this journey. I mean, both the parents, mom and dad, came out on seniors night and they surprised Didi when they put his name and number up in the rafters. And so already retired that name in Purdue history. So there's, you know, the support network is tremendous for him. And, you know, she's there at the Final Four. She's sitting in his press conference. They walk out into the hallway together. He's got some obligations. She's along for it. She's sitting there watching practice in a football stadium. All that helps. All that matters.
You talked about his pro prospects and how he's helped that stock. This is as of now, and it'll change depending on, you know, who decides to declare and who doesn't and what the overseas contingent looks like. But this is expected to be a weaker NBA draft class relative to some that we've seen in the last couple of years, which is why I maybe wouldn't be surprised if Edie snuck in the lottery. But I'm always stuck with the point in thinking, well, I can't think of that many amateur players that are that better than him. But on the flip side, I don't know how his game fits in today's NBA game. What do you make of his potential playing in the highest league in the world?
The honest question is, dude, and I mean this sincerely, I have no idea. Like, and I think that it almost feels, even though he's played 4 years of college basketball, he almost feels as an NBA prospect, as a one-and-done type guy. Like, only now are we really beginning to see what Zion could be, what RJ could be. It's not a coincidence they were in the same draft class. Like, it takes you a while to get used to the NBA game, to get your body up to that size, to understand what it takes to be a pro. There are very few who come in and just dominate right away at that level, you know, going from a 30-game season to an 82-game season, going up against 19-year-olds to going up against 29-year-olds. But Edie, even though he played four, it almost feels like he's coming into a one-and-done situation because there have been so few years of development. He's continuing to get better. Like, anybody you talk to, just say, like, he's nowhere near his ceiling yet. So it's hard to really get a gauge of what he can be because his skill set, his body type is so different than everybody else. And because he isn't that finished product. I think it's going to take a little while. I think it's going to take some patience. I think there's got to be... His best case scenario is ending up in a situation where he doesn't have to be the guy. If he can just be a complementary part, let's just say he ends up in Oklahoma City, you know, Shea's the guy, Holmgren's there. If he can kind of be the Robin to Holmgren's Batman with Shea as the head of the snake, that's the spot to be where there's not going to be as much of a spotlight because everybody else is getting theirs. So I think that kind of weighs into the whole equation of it too.
I'm curious if you learned from him how he's viewing his summer. My assumption is, although he's given so much credit to his time with the national team and it helping his game continue to develop, that given what the summer looks like in terms of getting ready to be in the NBA, that he probably won't be part of the contingent going to Paris, which even saying that out loud is a bummer because part of the reason why we haven't had our best talent all together at the same time is for a lot of these years, some of our best talent was entry-level players in the NBA. Did you get a sense, did the conversation turn at all to what the... you know, last piece of the puzzle after qualifying for that team might look like and if there's any possibility he could be a part of it?
I didn't talk to him about it, but I've got a pretty good understanding of what, you know, from a Canada basketball standpoint, what they're expecting. Their hope is that Edie's going to be with them the first week of July when they're down there for training camp in Vegas and for the USA game. But they don't expect whoever drafts Edie is going to basically clear him to go to Paris. They're going to want him to play summer league. They're going to want him to be in their environment. They're fully understanding of that. Now, Donovan, this is menace, no disrespect, but Zach Edey was the 11th guy or the 12th guy of 12 on the World Cup team. There he is, you know, when you talk about not just the starting five, but the first three or four off the bench, Edie's name isn't coming up yet. Might be a different story for LA 2028. And they want him there as part of the development. And truth be told, he'd probably develop better going up against the national team guys for Canada. But you know what pro sports franchises are like. They have everything figured out themselves. The way they do things is better. So Zach's probably going to stay behind and play summer league.
Big break for Brandon Clark, I suppose. I don't know. With Trey Lyles, potentially.
I would say Trey Lyles, absolutely, is probably to be considered in that last bit. Like, I think Melvin Edgem makes that team. A lot of people don't kind of have him on the bingo card. But he's the vet. He's the guy everybody looks to. He's the guy everybody listens to. He plays FIBA. He's been through it. But I would think size-wise, it's Olynyk, it's Trey Lyles, and oh my God, I'm having a brain fart. Dwight Powell. And Dwight Powell is where the size is going to come from. Now, they're hopeful, thinking, wondering about Tristan Thompson, but we'll see what happens there.
Yeah, I mean, this is the conversation that's happening, has happened since last summer in various Canada basketball group chats among fans and friends across the country is, you know, that core that you so stridently professed you were making commitment towards, you know, when push comes to shove, how much tweaking do you make in and around it to make sure that you can put your best foot forward in what, and it could just be my hyperbole and excitement, but in what I expect to be like the most competitive international basketball tournament we've ever had. Like when you look at the amount of good players, you know, across the board, I mean, there's great teams who haven't even qualified yet. It's a good problem to have.
It's a great problem to have here. And this is the end. Like, if we're going really far into the weeds, 2 weekends ago at Humber College in Etobicoke, Canada basketball had a development camp, whatever you want to call it, for 17 and 18 year olds. And there, I was told there were 3 7-footers there. One of them, Olivier Rieu, I believe his name is 7'7", headed to the University of Florida next year. Kid from suburban Montreal. There are some big men coming. It's just a ways off right now. So would they be ready for 28 in LA? I'm not sure. We just don't have them now. So it's just going to, but don't worry. It's coming. It's just, you know, you can't hit fast forward on the age thing, unfortunately.
No. UConn has hit fast forward on the blue blood thing, as they clearly, you know, are in that class, back to back national titles. You know, I think for me, I mean, I know the Florida team was great, but that Florida team was the same. When you talk about what Hurley has been able to do in the NIL transfer portal, you know, somewhat still one and done era, to be able to win back to back, getting, you know, freshmen to buy in, transfers to buy in, I think it's, you know, somewhat remarkable. Where do you place this team? Because it's just me. I can't have the like greatest team ever conversation because just the eras in college basketball are so different. How you compare, you know, the UNLV Run Rebels to, you know, John Wooden's Bruins to, you know, this team. It's literally impossible because it's virtually a different sport. But what Hurley has been able to do in 2 different years, how impressive is that feat to you?
Oh, incredibly. They did get their big man back for another year. Their backcourt has 2 fifth-year guys who combined for like 300 games together, which obviously helps a ton. But it's so interesting. I was, you know, watching that Connecticut game, and all I could think about was the day before and how South Carolina's women's team did it. Because, you know, starting five, South Carolina versus Iowa, pretty even. The Hawkeyes may have even been better. But then came South Carolina's bench. And they just had so many players who could beat you. And then Monday night rolls around, and here comes Connecticut, and there's so many ways they can beat you. When Klingon went to the bench with the third foul, I'm saying to myself, all right, here we go. Here is Purdue's chance for a run. It was a 9-point game. Their big 7-foot-2 guy is out. This is the chance for the second-best 3-point shooting team to get some open looks because you know they're going to double Zach Edey. Game on. And with Connecticut's big man on the bench, the Huskies still outscored the Boilermakers. That's how deep they are. That's how good they are. And, Don, I'm just going to get on my soapbox for one little moment, because the day before the tournament started, somebody asked Danny Hurley about NIL and blah, blah, blah. And he said that he has coached this team harder than any team he's ever had. His line was, I coached the hell out of these guys. And he said they have a responsibility to work harder and to represent UConn and to fight their absolute ass off to win games for the donors, for the fans, because of everything that they get that the past players didn't get. So you watch Connecticut play, and not only do they have the horses, and not only were they the best team this season, but their basketball IQ is off the charts. One of the smartest teams in terms of execution. They just made the proper decisions over and over again. So when you have that as your culture, and when you have that as the way you go about it on the floor, and when you have that kind of depth, whew, yeah, this is an all-time back-to-back that they just put together.
Yeah, it's funny because, one, I thought the two championship games somewhat mirrored each other in the fact that you've got this, you know, great player, best player, you know, at this level on the floor, and then a great team with great depth. And the decision was, we'll let that great player go off, but they can't outscore our entire team. We're not allowing their greatness to get everybody else involved and get shots. And whether it was Caitlin Clark and, you know, South Carolina, or, you know, Zach Edey essentially versus UConn, stylistically very different, but I thought some symmetry in the approaches and the outcomes. The thing when I hear you talk about Hurley and his statements is, I think we forget that hard things are hard, right? Jim Harbaugh coaches his team hard. They win a national championship. Dawn Staley coaches her team hard. They win a national championship. Hurley the same way. And Rex Chapman was telling a story in his book and told it again online about the fact that Steph Curry, you know, as we now know, and he's made it his slogan as a, you know, as a underrated person, didn't have any, you know, major Power Five offers, goes to Davidson, you know, after his first year. The cavalry is coming. Everybody wants him. Duke wants him. Kentucky's trying to get Rex Chapman to talk to him because he's good friends with Del Curry. Steph sleeps on it for a day and tells his dad, F them. They didn't want me then. I don't want to go there now, which I love. And it tells you a little bit about, you know, the person and the person he would become. But I think that's gone. Like, I think all of that is gone. That perspective. But I don't know if I can blame it, because your coach might be gone. your conference might be gone, right? Like, there is nothing solid about the college sports landscape. So, in a way, I wonder if that sort of thinking applied today in this era, it could be somewhat naive. What do you make of where we've gotten to, where literally, like, it's become a political football in terms of senators lobbying, you know, legislature so that their state has better NIL rules so that their state school can win?
I mean, look, is the toothpaste out of the tube? Yeah. Is it ever going back in? Impossible. Are some coaches coaching with the fear that if I coach them too hard, we're going to lose them in the portal? I guess maybe. But don't you have to just be who you are and just do right by your athletes the way you think they're supposed to? You know, how often have we heard control what you can control? Like, if you're an athlete, if you're a coach, if you're an administrator, if you're 99.9% of the people who draw a paycheck in college athletics, you aren't going to be able to control conference realignment or what's going on outside of it. I have no problem with the portal. I have no problem with NIL because athletes got to get theirs. The issue is it's going to already maybe ruining the business of college athletics because ratings on the men's side were down again because there's other than Edie, there's no real connection that a viewer would have with these players. You know, if we really want to turn back the clock in the pre-internet era, we all knew who Grant Hill and Christian Laettner and Bobby Hurley were at Duke because they were there for 3 or 4 years. And I don't begrudge players leaving for the NBA or going to the portal because there's more NIL money for them. Get it while you can. It's big business. But the consequence of this all happening is going to be that the large establishment is going to fizzle away and super conferences are going to exist. And there's going to be 24 haves and a whole pile of have-nots. And then I don't know what's going to happen from there.
Well, that's the last place I want to end it. Is there's a story in Time Dwell during the tournament that came out in The Athletic that essentially says on the table is a Super League with your 80 favorite programs with potential for some relegation towards the bottom of it. And I wonder if, you know, although that makes a lot of fiscal sense and would be great content for the networks and the streamers, if that would go against part of the intrigue and value proposition of college sports, specifically football, in that the regional aspect of it actually matters. Michigan, Ohio State, and, you know, Michigan State matters because of the proximity and the fact that in Big Ten country, whether you are playing sports or in the business sector, like where you went to school really matters. Or families who only go to specific institutions or to Big Ten schools, so on and so forth. I wonder if...
And at some point, and I know that, you know, we scoff at this, but like, let's remember that even in that national championship game, the majority of the players on the floor aren't going to play pro. At some point, doesn't class and education weigh into any of this? Like, if you're USC and you're going to be playing basketball games on Thursday and Saturday in Ann Arbor, Michigan, what day are you leaving campus and what day are you getting back and how's your jet lag and what are you doing? Like, what are we even doing here?
Well, I mean, you're not talking about the USC field hockey players. Well, actually, I don't know if USC has a field hockey team, but the USC female soccer players who are not flying, you know, direct in a booster's PJ to go to the Midwest, or, you know, taking connecting flights, or, you know, potentially taking a bus. I love college sports, but my fear is at some point, if you're just making this a minor league, I don't watch minor league baseball. And I, you know, other than affordable tickets, 20 minutes from my house, I don't watch G League basketball. It's going to lose some of what makes it great, because it's not the greatest athletes, quite frankly. The players in the G League are better than, you know, many of the players playing in NCAA basketball.
In West Lafayette, Indiana, in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, in Ames, Iowa, in Pullman, Washington, there ain't much more to do.
Fair.
You know, I still think that there is so embedded, like, they don't care about the athlete. Like, we understand that. And I think they believe that they're still going to be selling tickets 2x2 in those places because of how embedded college sports is into the culture of communities. You know, you're also not going to football games on Friday nights in Mississauga and Brampton and the rest. But you can't get a ticket to a high school football game in Texas, right? So it's just regionally, I still think that there's still gonna be a following at the expense of those out there on the field, court, ice, etc. We're gonna have to grind through it. But then again, when's the last time the NCAA or any of the adults really cared about the kids?
That is true. The town doesn't shut down when the Lorne Park Knights are playing on Friday night. They definitely should. You know, the Final Four towns essentially are taken over by the Final Four, and I'm somewhat biased because I've had the pleasure of going as a fan and as a media member. But I love this sporting event. But you have, you know, poured some cold water on sporting events that I thought I would love in the past, like the Super Bowl, and you spoke truth that it's not actually the event that it's all made up to be, and it's somewhat corporate. And I think the Final Four is creeping to that place where it is about salespeople taking out their clients, and not necessarily just, you know, the shots of the kids who are paraded in there behind the basket so it looks like it's a sporting event. It's been a while since I've been, though. Where is it now? Like, if we are educating our sports fans on the bucket list things to go, obviously, you know, the golf tournament that's just around the corner at Augusta for many is on that list. But a Final Four for you, given everything you've been able to experience, is where on that list?
This one was really cool, I'll be honest. And I think it had a lot to do with the fan bases, especially for the final. Like, that place was 70% Purdue and probably, or 65% Purdue and 25% UConn and then 10% everybody else. Neutral site environments are often garbage. As you mentioned, we've talked about it, but this one was different. And maybe it was because it was Purdue's for the first time in forever. And maybe it's because Connecticut is as blue blood as it gets and the basketball program there matters, but you couldn't go anywhere all weekend without seeing somebody in a Purdue shirt. Like, they were everywhere. And so they made that football stadium pop. Like, they put 74,000 people in that stadium on Monday night. Donovan, I'll tell you, it felt like 65,000 of them were actually there for the game. And it was a blast. So didn't think I'd say it. I've been to neutral site games before for college basketball, and they have lacked. This weekend did not.
I want to get one more thing from you before I let you go. And I feel like the main audience for my podcast is university journalism students. Those are the only spaces where I get a high percentage of people being like, hey, I listened to this episode. And with that in mind, I'd love for you to speak on what makes a great producer. Now, you are an on-air talent, but you also produce yourself. But we both had the pleasure of working with someone who we recently lost, Glenn McDonald, who for me, and I was spoiled at the beginning because he was my first producer and was the best. And the great ones that I had were, no surprise, people that work with him and he trained. But, using Glennie as an example, what makes a great producer? Because, they're kind of like an offensive line. Like, you do need them. You can succeed without them, but they help. What about Glennie stuck out to you about being such a great pro in our industry?
Well, Glennie understood people, and Glennie understood what a good story was, and Glennie was overprepared. So when you come into a situation and you're as prepared as you're going to be, this is what made Jason Kelce great, using the offensive lineman analogy. If you know what your opponent's going to do, and every tendency and every technique and every tell, then when you get to the line, you're then just reacting in the moment to what's happening in front of you. And that's what good storytelling and good producing is. I had done a ton of prep on the Boilermakers coming into this thing. I'd worked with Zach Edey last summer, and I was familiar with Zach's story. I knew that his mom had come to Asia last year because I saw her there. I saw when she arrived in the hotel lobby, and they had a big hug, and they just sat there for an hour and chatted. I may or may not have been sitting at the bar drinking Heineken's, but that's a different story for another day. So when I saw mom walk down the hallway during when Zach was receiving his National Player of the Year award and came and sat in the press conference room, I immediately went to our camera operator, Mike Bradley, and I said, Mike, let's try and make today about Zach and his mom. Because that way, we're not just taking stuff off the podium that everybody else has. Then afterwards, we're going to go and try and find mom in the hallway and interview her. Let's try and get as many shots of the two of them as possible. Let's tell the story that nobody else has if they aren't here and they're not aware of the situation. Good producing and good storytelling is a good, good base of preparation, a good knowledge of who the characters are, and finding ways to tell their stories and finding stories that nobody else has. And that's something that Glennie Mack really kind of instilled in me, not by telling me, but by showing me and by the way he went about it.
Well, he also, I'm sure, showed you, listen to this advice, kids, that good producing can be done from the hotel bar. So good for you for finding that story there. That's awesome. Where are we going to see you, hear you, potentially read you next? Are you going to the WNBA draft, NBA draft?
Our pal Micho's got the WNBA draft. I'm going to be in a little bit of Olympic prep mode this week. The Canadian Swimming Championships are this weekend in Toronto, so I'll pop over there for a little bit. Next week, our friends at the Canadian Olympic Committee and Lululemon are going to do their unveil for the uniforms for Paris 2024. That's in Toronto. I'll be heading over to that. And then this guy, Lionel Messi, is coming to Canada. So I'm going to go try and track him down somewhere in Montreal next month.
Well, get yourself some Lulu tights for your trouble. Thank you, pal.
Thank you. Appreciate you, brother.
Thanks so much to Arash. You can follow him on X and on IG at Arash Madani, ArashMadani. And speaking of Vince Carter, if you go into our show notes of this episode, you can find a link to my article about the reason why we still love Vince or love to hate him, why he means so much to this franchise. I mean, you heard it well from Arash himself. But if you want to read my words on it, you can find it there. You can find us wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for finding this episode and sticking with us to the end. Like, favorite, share, subscribe if you're doing it via podcast right now. And If you're going to give less than 5 stars, just don't bother. And if you're listening via radio, thank you. Make sure you subscribe. Find us wherever you find your favorite podcasts. We've got some really good episodes coming down the pike that I'm excited about. Hope you are too. Talk to you soon.